This interview is done on the 4th of August, 21, by Mike Law, myself, and Jim Redpath, right?
Redpath.
Yeah. And so he's going to tell us how he got in the Army. Very interesting history. And we'll go from there. So there's where the microphones are. Please just speak slowly and distinctly and tell us a story about your parents. I like that one. About both your mother and father were into aviation, and you were born into it. Keep going.
Okay. So you may we can repeat what I just said?
Yes.
Oh, later. Okay.
All right,
okay.
Fine. Yeah. No, I'm serious.
Okay.
Yes, please repeat it.
All right. Well, my mother learned to fly for the Ferry Command in World War II, so she was an early pioneer. Mm-hmm. Of course, World War II, the whole country was gearing up to defeat Hitler. Mm-hmm. So it was a complete country effort to do that. And so women were being recruited, but the only way that they could join the military was they had to demonstrate the fact that they could fly. Mm-hmm. So they had to go through government-sponsored flight schools and get their private license. And then, after she got the license, she wasn't old enough without her parents' permission to join. And her mother would not sign permission for her to join. So after she got her license, then she went on to teach school and didn't do that. Well, but my father, who didn't have his license yet, they used to go Dutch treat, and so he could build up his time and go flying, so that he ended up, he had an S on his wing, so he was a pilot before he went into the Army Air Corps. And then, you know, he graduated high, and I guess because I was in the hangar, they kept him back.
Where was this?
This was at Brady, it's Curtis Field in Brady, Texas.
Okay.
And so this is where he was a instructor pilot in T-6s.
Okay.
So.
So you were born during the war?
Yeah.
Yeah?
September 16, 1943.
43. Okay, fine. So your mother had enough break from the flying career to at least have a baby and keep going from there.
Yeah, and had five more after me.
Okay. So you eventually grew up and go to high school and... you've been flying. You said you got your solo license at private pilot's license at 16?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, solo at 16.
Uh-huh.
That was the earliest you can solo a powered aircraft.
Oh, okay.
A glider, I think, is 14, but at any rate, so.
Yeah.
So.
So then your father and your mother helped you get your real private pilot's license?
So they were in the aviation business.
Mm-hmm.
So my father was had a flight school, and my mother ran the books for that. So the two of them then operated flight schools throughout my early years. And so I just gradually in the process, as I got old enough to do whatever needed to be done, well, that was the process of it all. And
so when did you graduate from high school and where?
At 1963 at Lubbock High School.
Okay, fine. Lubbock, Texas. Okay. So you go to college at Tech for 2 years?
Yeah.
And then, you were football, you said.
Yeah.
And so you and football decided to part ways?
As much as I love the game, I was not athletic enough. I wasn't good enough. I had gone to a level that I obviously, this is one of, and we all have failures in life, and this was... This was one of my first ones, which was, maybe not the first. I eloped earlier. It was around the same time. Anyway, so.
You're young and bulletproof.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you end up at BYU for a while, but that was not a full football. Were you playing football for them?
No. That was that changeover. So, okay, well, now I need to focus on something else.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to BYU for a year.
Uh-huh.
And then said, okay, no. I'm not going to be a psychologist.
Uh-huh.
So that was then the next failure, so to speak, of my where I was going in life.
Change of course. Now,
yeah.
Come on.
Well, we have to do that. You know, we run into weather. whether it's psychological or what their obstacles in life.
That's right.
Maybe the performance characteristics of the vehicle that we inhabit are not capable of whatever. We can't carry that kind of load, or we can't go that fast, or we can't do something. So we have to stay within those limits.
So you come back from BYU and you go back to Tech, or?
No. So then I come back and get my commercial and my flight instructors.
So you're old enough.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, fine.
So that's when I need to get back. I've already done all the grunt work for the aviation. I've already done all this stuff.
Yeah, right.
And that's what I realized with all the grunt work I was having to do to get that degree in psychology, all the different kinds of part-time jobs I was having. I was going, wait a minute. Yeah. I'm starting all over again. I've already done all this.
Yeah.
And so that was the epiphany where, I've rebelled long enough.
So you didn't finish your degree at that time?
No, I did not.
That's fine. So you were coming back from work when you ran into that machine?
Yeah.
And so you're...
I'm an instructor pilot for the T-41 program.
Oh, okay, fine.
At Laughlin, and then I moved to Lubbock and continued that.
All right.
And then I hit...
So the Air Force wouldn't let you in because you didn't have a degree, but you can be an instructor pilot for them.
Right, right.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, see, they were short of pilots, so they needed, that was another similar situation where there was a need, whatever the need may be, just as your story talked about. You know, it depends on where the vacuum is. That's what you get sucked into.
Amen, amen. So you had seen helicopters before.
Yeah.
But you know, you had at that point in time when you had that accident, how many hours in fixed wing did you have?
I'm going to guess maybe 1,000. I had to look at my logbook.
But I mean, that's a respectable number.
Yeah.
You need 200 for a commercial.
Right.
But you know, you had way past that.
Yeah.
And so that would have been your lot in life, was just to continue to be a instructor pilot until something new came along.
Yeah.
But then you had the accident, and that did a job on you.
Yeah. So that's where the no more military deferment, see.
Yeah.
I mean, Vietnam's going strong. I'm fulfilling a need here by being a civilian instructor pilot, but now I can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So now I pop up and I'm available for the draft.
Yeah.
And so then
it's an infantryman. If you can't be a pilot, you know, well, we can do this for you. Okay, you get your draft for the military. It could have been the Marines or the Army.
And so then I decided the best thing for me to do
is
use what I've got going for me.
Rather
than being a ground pounder, get the most I got going for me is the fact I can fly.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to join.
Yeah.
And I'll go for that rather than...
So you go see the recruiter in Lubbock and you tell him you want to be a pilot, and his eyes get about this big.
Well, I am a pilot.
Yeah, right.
I want fixed wing. You know, I want to go out. What can I do here?
So,
it's Mohawks. I'm an automatic.
Sure.
I'll be a Mohawk pilot. Good. I can do that.
So when do you get into the Army? What day? Do you remember?
I went to Amarillo. Uh-huh. On my birthday in 1967.
Okay, 67.
Yeah.
All right.
September 16th, 67, I was on a bus to Amarillo to go take the medical.
You know, from Lubbock, there's not too many other exotic places, but Amarillo happens to be one.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so where do you go to basic training?
Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Okay, fine. And then you were not in, all right, fine. So you're in the pilot program. So after Fort Polk, they're going to send you to Rucker.
Walters.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. I forgot.
Yeah.
Got to stay.
Everybody's got to go through Walters.
Yes. All right. So you get to Walters, and you said, wait a minute, there's a mistake here. I don't know what these helicopters are all about. I'm a fixed wing guy. I'm supposed to go to Mohawk school. So you go to the base commander, or you go to somebody, and
The base commander. This has been a big mistake here. You know, we got to get things changed. And of course, I'm a neophyte. You know,
right?
I don't know anything.
Temporary Spec 5.
So
he says, "Keep going, and we'll work on it."
Yeah, that's it.
And that's French for no. Okay, so you finish helicopter school, but you said you had a hard time hovering.
Yeah, I was one of the last ones in my class to solo.
Mm-hmm.
Because the hover part, it was like, you know, I had to undo some of my aviation knowledge.
Yeah.
Once you got the helicopter up and moving, it functioned the same.
Yeah.
Under different principles, basically, it functions the same. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah.
It's when you come in there and hover. Yeah. That's where getting used to that.
I had a terrible time hovering. All right, so you obviously got past that. Mm-hmm. And so you finished at Walters, no big problems?
Yeah.
No. So you went to Savannah, not Rucker?
Right.
All right, fine. I never went there.
Yeah.
I've been there, but I've never been there.
Not an Army Air Field.
Yeah. And so... So
it was a split. I think there was about 600 of us.
Yeah.
And so 300 went to Rucker, and the other 300 was went to Hunter.
So instruments, no problem.
So the instrument situation was, in fact, is then, and I was with a fellow that was one of my classmates, was a flying, he flew with the Flying Tigers Airlines. He was from Jersey. And so he and I ended up in the instrument program because of our experience.
Sure.
And so we're the mates, you know, because they'd have two students with each instructor.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were going through the instrument program.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come up to the day of the check ride, and he goes first, and they have an engine failure. And he auto hovers into the football stadium and lands. And the instructor says, "Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
You just passed your instrument."
Nothing to do with instruments, but you just passed. Okay. So you couldn't take a check ride that day because that airplane's busted.
Right. And so then, but in the meantime, I'm picking up the information here. I've seen a Cobra.
Oh, yeah?
And I said, "How do I get to fly that?" I said, "You got to graduate in top 10%. I said, "No sweat." And what I'm hearing here is that everybody gets their instrument, becomes a Charlie pilot.
Yeah.
Command and control. And I'm going, if I want to go over there, I want to be in the thick of it. I don't want to be, I don't want to do that. I want to be in the thick of it. I want to be able to shoot back.
Yeah.
So ISIE'd. Got the instrument.
Yeah.
When that happened, I said, okay, I'm not going to worry about it, but I'm not going to do this. I'm done.
All right.
So then we go on. I graduate top of my class, and then I get to Cobra School right there and do that, and then overseas into the 2nd and 20th.
All right. So were you married then?
Mm-mm.
No, that's fine. So going from graduating from primary helicopter school or rotary wing class, and then going right to Cobra School, that was just going across the airfield.
Yeah.
And so you finished that. When do you finish that?
That would have been, I graduated September, so because it was right at a year from the time I took the medical, so that was September. I got the chief warrant officer, and then had that
3 weeks later.
So, you know, I don't know. There wasn't enough time for me to go anywhere or do anything. I mean, it was just a matter of me and another guy that went to Cobra School with me, Lockridge. We ended up renting a trailer and starting the school. And it was a month long. School was a month long.
Okay, fine.
So if it was mid to late September, then it was October.
Yeah.
And then we had a little bit of time, whatever it was, to go home before we reported for duty.
Okay, fine. So when did you arrive?
December of 68, I went to Vietnam.
What early and what?
I think it was right around Christmas time.
All right, fine. So you come over, and you and your friend came over together, or did you arrive on the airplane I didn't know anybody on the airplane.
Yeah, I didn't know. As it turns out, I had a fellow that I was in throughout we ended up going the same place, Doug Mihalik. Mm-hmm. And his father was, he was an Air Force brat. Mm-hmm. And his father was a colonel in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And Doug was not a person that everybody just, he was a little unusual, a little standoffish, a little different, just, but I liked him, you know, and so we hit it off. Fact is, I taught him how to drive a car, because he had a pilot's license before he had a driver's license.
Unusual person. So you get to Vietnam, you're in there.
And he goes. Yeah. He ends up in the same unit I do. So throughout the military, strange as it may be, we continue to be...
buds.
Yeah, right.
So you go to the 90th, and eventually you end up with... Oh, the ARA, okay. So somebody says the Cavs calling.
We go with the first Cobras. Mm-hmm. So the unit I go into hasn't got Cobras yet. Mm. So we go in Charlie Bravo model gunships and do all that, and just little by little, within a month's time, we've got some Cobras on the line, and so it's a transition.
Okay. Now, so you're rated in the airplane, but you don't know the tactics as well as everybody else.
Well, and that's where we spent the first 3 or 4 months. It was only about 3 months for me. Most of them were about four. But I came in with, you know, I could pay attention to what's going on out here, not just a 200-hour pilot just concerned about manipulating the controls. Mm-hmm. That wasn't an issue for me.
Yes.
I had that consciousness was raised because of the kind of flight time and the fact that I've been around aviation as long as I had. So I was able to see what was going on. And so I graduated up to aircraft commander pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. It was the first of my group to do it.
So, so how many other guys in your platoon battery, were Cobra qualified when you got there? So there'd be like 40 pilots.
I don't think they're well. What are you talking about? Three platoons of eight plus the platoon leader, so nine. So there's 27, and the major or the captain, whoever's in charge. Mm-hmm. So there's 30. There's at most 30 pilots.
30 flying officers.
Yeah.
Right. Warrant officers or pilots, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Warrant officers or commissioned officers, it doesn't matter. But you were one of the first Cobra guys to come
in.
Yes. Okay. Fine. So everybody.
I just don't recall at the time.
That's fine.
You're busy. You're not necessarily counting heads of who's this and who's that, but just generally getting the lay of the land as far as what's going on.
Yeah.
And
well, ARA was a discipline unto itself. Go out, shoot. Don't talk. Don't nothing. Just shoot. Come back. Get more gas. More bullets. Go. Okay, so it was not finesse. There was no finesse involved. It was just shooting. So, anyway, sorry.
Well, and for instance, we had to have a check ride.
Oh, yeah.
To go to aircraft commander.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had to get another check ride to be a fire team leader.
Sure.
So you know it's that whole process that you go through.
So how many hours in the charter model did you get in Vietnam?
Not very much.
Yeah.
I'd have to look at my logbook.
But
I kept my logbook entries.
Well, of course, because you were a pilot.
I took my logbook.
6 weeks in Charlie Models, I'm making this up. Two months?
No, it wasn't very much.
I mean, okay, fine.
They were coming in.
Yeah.
You know, and we
and they wanted them online fast.
The few of us that were Cobra qualified all pretty much came in at the same time.
Okay.
And so we're already doing that, and so even though we're flying the aircraft, we've got a Bravo Charlie aircraft commander sitting in the front seat calling the shots here, and we're learning that end of it.
Right. No. Yeah. A lot of people did that, even in my troop. We did that. The aircraft commander was in the front seat, you know, because he was not rated in the snake.
Right.
So, all right, fine. So, is it fun?
Well,
is it fun shooting a Cobra in combat?
Okay. Well,
I think it is.
the adrenaline.
Yeah.
The clarity of that, that intensity was the biggest problem I had after I got out of the service.
Yeah.
I got back out of, from Vietnam. I mean, I, that was the PTSD in my life, was that I was had become an addict to that, that intensity and that clarity that you have when you're looking death in the face every day.
Yeah.
Every day you're shooting it out with somebody.
Yeah.
And they're shooting back. And it's like I walk away with over 300 firefights.
Yeah.
I walk away going, how in the world did they not nail me?
Yeah. Well, you're only 39 inches wide. So it's hard, and you're moving almost 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And when you turn that minigun on, that makes a tremendous amount of noise. And you're on the ground looking up at something that's only 39 inches wide, and it's moving really fast, and that minigun in the nose is tearing up your face. You put your head down. You don't shoot back.
Now, let me tell you, one night, I was coming back off a mission, and a dual caliber, 50 cal, opened up.
Uh-huh.
And he nailed me. Those, every fifth round, you know, it was a tracer.
Yeah.
And it was coming by the cockpit on each side.
Yeah, yeah.
Like flaming basketballs.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't climb, he'd get the blades. Or dive, he'd get the blades. I couldn't turn, he had me.
Yeah.
He had me.
Yeah.
All he had to do was just wiggle that.
Yeah.
Just a little bit, he had me. But he held it steady as it could be. And they just kept coming. All I could do was just roll in and start shooting those rockets right back.
Yeah.
And then when those tracers, that's how you knew, you know, and that happened so many times.
Yeah.
I knew that I had them because you saw those tracers.
Yeah, right.
So that was, that. Yeah. So to say that,
yeah.
I mean, it scares you.
Well,
in
does.
A fight, it scares you because they're hitting you. I mean, I've had them hit me. Armor piercing, 50 cals ripping up through that half-inch steel floorboard, taking out co-pilots' feet.
Yeah.
You know, they're screaming. They can't. They're useless.
Yeah.
They're a distraction.
Yeah.
But you just you shut everything out.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with the fact you're trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
And I go kamikaze. I go kamikaze. It's like, okay, I'll take it to the ground. I will kill you if I have to kill myself.
Yeah.
That's the kind of intensity.
Yeah,
and
well,
yes,
it's
something that after that was over, that
nothing to
coming back,
it.
Coming back to the States, it was like, I mean, I would get on that motorcycle and just, I mean, I'd go flat out for all I was worth. It was my good fortune was I came back to a family business so that I could take off. You know, with so many of these guys come back to some kind of a job they had to maintain, I would just take off sometimes. I've got to go. And I would just leave for days at a time, just to get
okay,
my
so,
head straight.
So you, let's defer that for a minute.
Yeah.
So you spent your entire tour with that one battery.
Yeah.
C battery the whole time. Well,
yeah.
Good for you. A lot of people de-roast around.
Why?
Well,
I know we had some. We had some after I got there that transferred out.
Yeah.
But part of the problem was that there was these guys. They had the ones that when I came in the particular situation, they had this. It was almost like a flight school. You know, they.
Organization or the regiment?
What's the word?
Mentality or processing?
The way they dealt with one another and whoever had been there longer and it was this pecking order and all this stuff that was like, what in the world are you, what is this?
Yeah.
And I would just, and some of them just, and I just I'd laugh at them. Are you kidding me? Are you really serious?
Yeah.
But see, then I was a year, 2 years older than most of them.
Yeah.
And I had a little bit of experience, you see.
Yeah.
That's that cussed independence. No, you're not going to pull this bullshit on me.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You're a child.
Yeah.
to do that.
Yeah.
To do this flight school. Well, just like you had all the guys that come in on the, you know, the upperclassmen. They'd come over and you'd be marching to your class, you know, and they'd stop you and harass you and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And if when I was leading it, if they weren't in uniform, I wouldn't pay attention to them, and they would just go ballistic. Yeah. I'd say, I don't know who in the world you think you are. You're not in uniform. I don't know who you are. I don't care. I knew who they were. I can recognize them.
They knew you knew.
But it was all about,
you
know, hey, we're
dress right dress. And you didn't buy that. Okay, fine. So
so there were guys that left because
Their
little kingdoms
were things
had changed.
Yeah.
And there were people that, I mean, there was one guy that I didn't realize until much later. I mean, he just really resented me.
Uh-huh.
And he stayed on, but he resented me because I took over.
Uh-huh.
I cannot help. I am, by golly, that's me. I'm pretty subtle about it, but it's like, okay, what's the lay of the land? What are we doing here?
Yeah.
I can't help it. That's just me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you run into that. And I ran into it throughout. That's the reason I say I didn't realize how much fighting I was going to do. When I went to Vietnam, I'd been fighting all the way through for that year in the Army. Before I got to Vietnam, it was one thing after another. So I was, you know, it was like, oh, okay, well, just some more of the same. So, but then I also bought 40 metaphysical books and took with me to Vietnam.
Oh, yeah?
Because I wanted to know who these people were, what their belief systems were, what they believed in. I wanted the philosophical and the spiritual fabric. I wanted to understand who I was fighting. What was going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Who are these people? Mm-hmm. You know, because I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Have you gone back to Vietnam?
No.
Fine.
I'd probably get shot if I were.
No, you wouldn't. Trust me. I did go back. And
well,
it was pretty, it's very interesting and positive, too. Okay, fine. So you make aircraft commander and you become a team leader relatively quickly later on and you just keep flying missions?
Yeah.
So about how many hours do you got?
900. I got 900 in Vietnam.
That's good. You did well. Were you involved in anything that got medals or citations or anything like that?
Yeah.
What did you receive?
Oh, you know, the good conduct service medal.
I'm talking about
medals, the air medals with V, the DFCs, Bronze Star, the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was about, and here again, I don't know because I left all that behind.
Okay, fine.
I didn't
That's
keep
fine.
Up, so I,
That's fine.
I don't even know. I'd have to study to see, okay, now which ribbon is this? You know, I'm going to have to go back and look in a book somewhere to tell me what that ribbon is.
Fine. Some people are pretty religious on that, and some people are not.
I understand.
Did you go on R&R?
Yes.
How many times? Once?
Just once.
Yeah? Where'd you go?
In that body escort, a buddy of mine.
Oh, okay. Those are not fun.
Yeah. And so that was, and he was... you know, so yeah, it's a.
All right. So, when you get ready to leave Vietnam, where were you assigned?
I wanted to go to Walters.
Uh huh.
I wanted to go back and be a primary instructor.
Okay.
First choice, second choice, third choice. That's where I wanted to go.
Okay.
Wasn't.
Didn't make the card.
I went to Hood.
Oh my gosh. Just one second.
Yeah.
Hey Dan, I'll have to call you back, okay? Hey Dan? Hello, hello? Got a hunch that was a butt call. I'm gonna interview this guy next Tuesday. Miraculously lived from Vietnam. He was a medic that got almost lost his leg. great story. Anyway, where were we? We were talking. You wanted to go to Walters, but okay. Where did you go?
So I went to Hood.
Okay.
Oh, and all right. And the reason.
Yeah.
They laid out the carpet. Said, "Welcome. We want you to start the second Cobra transition course."
Oh yeah. Okay.
And so, because I was instructor, civilian instructor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And first returning.
Yeah.
Cobra jock.
Yeah.
Said, okay, we want you to set this, and you just...
Well, not only that, they were firing up the 6th Cavalry Regiment or something there. At what did you say, Hood?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I finally got out of the Army, was at Hood. Okay, fine, so...
So I got it all organized. I set it all up. We checked out the guys, trained them, got them qualified in the Cobras. Mm-hmm. And then got them qualified as instructor pilots mm-hmm. in the Cobras.
Mm-hmm.
So I got about half a dozen of those guys up. Mm-hmm. And this captain comes along, and I didn't realize he was sitting back in the wings. And says, "You're going out to the field to play war games. I'm taking this over because I want that feather in my cap."
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where I ended up there.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you stay at Hood?
So I was at Hood until May 11th.
Of
71.
Okay.
So I was there about 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And tornadoes.
70. It was 70, honey.
70 or 71?
It was 70 for sure. I know.
All right, fine.
Okay. 3 tornadoes.
Yeah?
Simultaneously hit Lubbock.
Mm.
Wiped out all the communications. I had a friend of mine who lived in a little town outside, 25, 30 miles outside of Lubbock.
You're saying Lubbock, but you meant Hood, right?
No, Lubbock.
Okay, fine.
And so he calls me.
Yeah.
And he says, "We had all these tornadoes hit Lubbock." He said, "I drove by the airport. Your family's airplanes and everything, the whole fleet is in just shambles.
Mm.
I don't know what's happened. I don't know what's going on, but I felt like you ought to know."
Yeah.
So I go to my CO. Yeah. The major is on leave. So I got a buttercup.
Yeah.
XO.
Yeah.
That's second lieutenant, just out of OCS.
Yeah.
He's got to follow the book. Yeah. He does not have the wisdom or the authority or anything else to do other than this. And I didn't have any leave coming.
Oh, okay. That's a problem.
Because,
yeah, right.
Because I re-upped. I was going back for a second tour.
Oh, okay.
And I got home and I took a 30-day leave.
Yeah.
And so I go to, and I've been having this ringing because I had a mortar go off. I mean, it had a delayed fuse and it was across the table. It wasn't any further than from here to the table.
Yeah.
But delayed fuse, it penetrated the earth before it blew up.
Uh-huh.
And I flattened out in a little drainage ditch, just as it, because I thought it was going to hit me in the head, and it probably would have. I was running down the flight line because we were being overrun.
Sure.
At Quan Loy. So it explodes. I got...
Rattle your cage.
My ears are... Well, and it really, that was the point at which, because I always wondered, What was my limit?
Mm.
How much could I manage to take? Mm. How much stress before I'd break?
Mm.
And when that thing blew, and I was clawing air, and that was the panic.
Mm.
And I wondered where my panic was, what I could take and what I couldn't.
Mm.
And that was, when that thing blew, it bounced me off of the ground, and I was clawing air. And but of course, ever since then, that I had that ringing in the ear. So I go to ear, nose, and throat doctor. Well, he happens to be a retired Air Force physician. And he says, "Your eardrums are blown out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the reason that you go to hearing. You're grounded. You can't go." So I didn't go. So I didn't go back for the second tour because I'm grounded now. So then. I'm on the ground until all this stuff works out, and So I didn't have any leave coming when this happens. And I'm going, to get some, I'm saying, how about emergency leave, something? No, can't do it. I go, man, you know, I can't, I got to do something. Like, what can we do? What can I, you can't do it. Can I pay for it? Can I do, can you take it out of my pay? No, he was not, he was not varying any outside of those rules that he had to follow. And I don't, there was no personal blame there.
I
look back and say, well, that's where he was. So I said,
I leave.
Screw you guys.
All right.
I'm going to go see my family. I'm out here playing war games. This is not important. And nobody knows what's going on because all the telephone lines are down, so nobody knows about all this stuff.
I'm doing an interview.
What does this pertain to?
Your oral histories.
Oh, okay. I'll pass. Thank you very much.
Okay, fine.
All right. You're just trying doors. All right, so you take off.
Yeah, I do. I go to see what's going on. Well, family's okay. The business is obliterated.
Yeah.
So then it's a matter of, okay, we got to clean up the stuff, and because we're VA and TEA approved
schools,
mm-hmm. we have there is no you've got to maintain 60% of, is all that you can have, but you've got to maintain this momentum, and so we had to go find and rent airplanes and bring them back in to keep the program going. And so I'm running around doing that, and we get all that stuff done. And so then, I guess, you know, I'm not ready to go back. So I ended up being a best man at one of our classmates' weddings. And so then I end up going out there and spending a couple of weeks out there until I get my 30 days up, and I say, okay, I got to go home. So went home. My dad flew me back down to Hood. I showed up to, so I wouldn't be in the desertion class. And so, you know, they lowered the boom on me then.
Yeah, right. So you were AWOL for a couple, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
did that end your time in the Army?
Well, yeah. Well, then they also, at the same time, yeah, that ended it. Because at the same time, so I got out with everybody else on the early outs because of the saturation thing.
Yeah.
In 70. So, but less than honorable discharge.
Oh, yeah. They really love you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah, but...
We love you.
I left that behind, you know, and said, okay, this is... And that was part of the problem that I ran into once I got back was I was dealing with all the politics.
Yeah.
And...
There was too much fun.
I'm not a politician. You give me something to do, tell me what's going on here, and then leave me alone, let me go do it. But you start messing with me with a bunch of stuff here, no, I'm not going to play that game.
So what did you do when you and the Army did separate? Did you go back with your parents?
Or? Yeah. So I continued the flight school until their deaths in 74 and 79, and then I started as a corporate pilot. I started flying corporately. Mm-hmm. So I flew turboprops then until I'm basically insurance won't cover me anymore. and a few stints in the old ticker here kept me, so I don't have medical anymore either. So,
So you sold your mother and father's school?
Yeah, well, we just sold out the airplanes because it was a time there when there was no value there.
Oh.
So it was just a matter of selling the airplanes, finishing out everything, and then I started flying for other people.
Oh, all right.
Because I was chief instructor pilot, chief pilot, all that stuff in the flight school up until that point. So.
Mm-hmm. So.
Now I manage an airplane. The same one I've flown for 16 years.
Yeah.
I manage it for the new owner that just bought it because the previous owner that I flew for died of COVID last year. And so the family said, sell the airplane. So I sold it And he's held me over because he's never owned an airplane before, so I manage the airplane. Mm-hmm. Just had paint and interior done, and it's in inspection, major inspection now at Brody's at Fort Worth. So I'll go back there next week and monitor their finishing that thing up. And then I'm ranked about number two or three on the co-pilot list. That even though the insurance doesn't cover me, I've got 25,000 hours. So the owner says, look, you know, he's just like the last owner. He says, look, I want you up in that cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the best insurance I got, so I want you up there. So
yeah, that's it.
So still at it.
Well.
Just part-time.
We wouldn't want you to be bored.
No.
So, yeah, that's good. So, oh yeah, you joined the BHPA really recently.
Yeah. Well, they couldn't find me. I was back there in the back somewhere, but they lost it.
Yeah, right. Anyway, okay, anything else for this tape recorder that you can think of? Now, we can do an addendum later on.
Yeah.
And if you go home and you say, oh, I remember in Vietnam, I was really excited about this, and I don't care what it is.
You probably, well, let me describe probably my most significant battle.
Okay.
It was LZ Eagle 2 on August the 16th of 69. And I was the first fire team on station. They were being overrun by a couple of battalions of VC. They're right there south of the Cambodian border. And I was first one on station talking to the ground commander.
Mm-hmm.
And he was giving me the situation when they had, the VC had four 50 cals sitting on each end of the LZ and got us in a crossfire.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, normally our approach was we roll in, we put in a marking round break, and then the ground commander adjusts the next one. And we do that until we get
standard right artillery stuff.
Yeah, aerial rocket artillery.
Uh-huh.
So that we're doing that, we got this, so that we're each, the timing-wise, as this one breaks, this one's in here to give them cover fire and to put down the next round. So that's that whole timing has to be there. Well, you're in a crossfire like this. It just, they already figured this thing out. The BC figured this thing out. They had us dead to rights. I got on station, and I'm talking to him, and something, and this is the reason, one of the reasons I'm still here, is because I've got a sixth sense that I'll just pick up on things. I don't know why, don't know what it is, but something just, and so I just hesitated. I just backed up. I was just in that cruise. I was sitting up there cruising, getting the information on the ground situation. And they opened up on us. And right before they opened up on us, I just hesitated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, instead of that 50 cal coming up and hitting me, it hit the co-pilot.
Mm.
And so, and then it was just, and then of course then it's there, it's just a volume of tracers coming from all four directions.
Mm-hmm.
So I just rolled in on the one I'm pointed at.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of doing the pattern, I'm shooting at him until I see the flares go, and then I just go right, and because he's next, and I did it on all four, and then we boogied home, and there wasn't any more 50 cals that night.
Mm.
All that was going on for that, because it was an all night mission.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happened to the guy in the front seat? He was wounded pretty bad.
Yeah, he lost part of his foot.
And
went home.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I'd have to look back through my logbooks again.
That's fine. I got a couple of people that tell me the same kind of stories relative to particularly 50s. And so, yeah. You've done good, kid.
Well, I survived. I mean, that's the key right there. And, of course, we had the heat-seeking missiles, you know. You could hear them on the box mic.
No, I didn't get to enjoy those.
Oh, but you heard about it.
I do.
Yeah, that was frightening.
Yeah, no, I'll bet it was. Yes. No, I
And the flak.
Yeah.
Down around Benoit, close to Saigon, one night we were helping out the Playboys down there in Benoit, because they had more than they could manage. And so we were going out on missions with them and ran into flak.
Mm.
And I'm going, what in the world is this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I heard about the beeping on the radio. Two guys that were with me in my time experienced that in Laos, but I haven't. So I listen to the stories. I understand what's going on. I know the weapon works, how the weapon works. But I didn't experience myself. Thank you very much. So who would you say you're, other than the people that you've mentioned, who are your best friends in Vietnam?
Hmm. Well, you know, the thing about it was Doug Mihalik, I saw him once after that. And this was back in, it was back in the, mid-70s sometime. He went on and joined the Coast Guard, and I think he probably, being a Air Force brat, he probably finished up there. But then he called once, and I missed his call, and that was back before, you know, you could trace the number and all that type of thing. And so he just left a message, and so I missed him by about 10 minutes and didn't know who to call or how to reach him. And outside of that, never saw him again at that one time.
Mm.
But he was my wing shift that night.
Mm.
And on other occasions there was a lot of times there when we were, because we're both same platoon, so we had those kind of missions. So, you know, he was the kind of, for me, for my personality type, he was just a steady, right there, no nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much we had the camaraderie or anything else, but we just worked well together. And a lot of that had to do with him working with me, not me working with him.
Good.
The credit goes to him in knowing how to be a good wingman.
Yeah. That's good.
So outside of that, some other, you know, I had another fellow that I knew over there that, I don't know, he must have gotten some trouble. I haven't been able to reach him in years. He lived down in Houston, Bernie Conrad. And he was there beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So he had, you know, he graduated in an earlier class and ended up in the same place. But but he was a good guy. I went out to Hawaii and spent a couple of weeks out there with he and his girlfriend and got to hang out and kind of enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was another one, but I haven't talked to him in forever either. So
you know, some of these are kind of like lifelong pursuits. When I first started the VHPA, I wanted to talk to this guy named Dan. Never talked to him. But I've made hundreds of other friends, but I've never talked to Dan. And that's the way it goes. Anything else for this recorder?
Yeah, I think I'll do it. Well, you got other things to do here.
No, I don't. Except eat lunch and get ready for my stuff this afternoon. Anyway, okay, I'm going to turn this off then. Okay. Thank you.